you know, cancer didn't form overnight, right? By some estimates, we'll never know it precisely, but some estimates say, you know, by the time a tumor is detected, it's been there at least 5 years. So my cancer likely took anywhere from 2 to 10 years to form. And so if I want to take another 2 weeks, 3 weeks to make my decision on my course of treatment, take it, do the research, talk to other clinicians, get second opinions, third opinions, however many opinions you need to feel okay.
This is the Healthy Lifestyle Solutions podcast, and I'm your host, Maya Acosta. If you're willing to go with me, together we can discover how simple lifestyle choices can help improve our quality of life and increase our longevity in a good way. Let's get started. Welcome back, friends, to another episode of the Healthy Lifestyle Solutions podcast. I'm your host, Maya Acosta, and a heartfelt welcome to all of my new listeners joining us today. So as we step into October, we enter a month that's profoundly significant for millions of women worldwide, Breast Cancer Awareness Month. In a new study, researchers from the International Agency for Research on Cancer, also known as IARC, and partner institutions provide a global overview of the burden of breast cancer in 2020 and estimate the impact this disease will have in 2040. The authors predict that by 2040, the breast cancer burden will increase to more than 3 million new cases per year, an increase of 40%, and more than 1 million deaths per year, an increase of 50%. Breast cancer is the most commonly diagnosed cancer type, accounting for 1 in 8 cancer diagnoses worldwide. And in 2020, there were about 2.3 million new breast cancer cases globally and about 685,000 deaths from this disease, with large geographical variations observed between countries and world regions. But in the midst of these staggering numbers, there's a message of hope, empowerment, and resilience that we want to share with you today. It's a message that underscores the power of lifestyle medicine and choices in the face of adversity. In this episode, we'll revisit the inspiring journey of Kelly Nardone, a breast cancer survivor who chose to embark on a path less traveled. Instead of solely relying on traditional treatments, Kelly discovered the incredible potential of whole food, plant-based nutrition, and the alternative therapies in this healing journey. Her story highlights the importance of informed decision-making, the impact of diet on health, and the possibilities that exist beyond the conventional treatment options. So whether you or a loved one have faced the challenges of breast cancer, are interested in health and wellness, or simply seek inspiration for positive lifestyle changes, stay tuned. Kelly's story is a testament to the resilience of the human spirit and the remarkable potential of lifestyle medicine in the face of adversity. Let's meet Kelly. Welcome, Kelly.
Oh, thank you for that beautiful introduction, Maya. Pleasure to be here.
Thank you for being here again. And I want to remind people that have been following me on the podcast that we met at the Vegan Women Summit. I had the opportunity to chat with you. As a matter of fact, I was working in the media room and you were one of the speakers. You were part of a panel discussion on plant-based nutrition, but it was more than that. Do you want to tell us a little bit about it? And I believe you moderated that discussion.
I did. Yes. It was a great honor and a lot of fun and a real blessing to meet you as well there. So thank you for having me back. Yes, we put together a panel, myself and three other board-certified lifestyle medicine physicians, Drs. Robin Tiger, Dr. Melissa Sunderman, and Dr. Janelle Gordon. And we sought to address the question, is a plant-based diet the solution to our healthcare crisis? And, you know, where we landed was certainly it's one of them and a big part of it, considering that 80 to 90% of chronic diseases are driven by our lifestyle choices. So that was what we addressed in a very small window of time. We didn't even scratch the surface, but I did share my story.
The panel discussion was well attended. So first of all, I guess this is like a two-part question. My first question is, how did you make a decision to do so? Because it is, you know, not everyone's comfortable sharing their story. And what was the response right afterwards with other women possibly approaching you?
Sure. Thank you. Well, I didn't realize that's how you came to be at the Women's Summit. So thank you for sharing that. So why I decided to attend and how that came to be in terms of my participation was I was following the Vegan Women's Summit, much like you were on social media. And yes, I had the same impression that it's all about women founders and, you know, vegan food and fashion and things that perhaps are not of primary interest to me in large part. But I thought, you know, I know the power of plant-based nutrition in my life in the 2 years since diagnosis. And I thought, we've got to get this message out there more broadly. And I was hoping they would have a health component. And so on LinkedIn, I saw a little dialogue, you know, comment between Drs. Sunderman and Tiger, whom I also followed because I had first discovered Dr. Sunderman on a podcast with Rip Esselstyn, the Plant Strong podcast, her interview, and began following her, where she tagged Dr. Tiger and said, hey, let's pitch it. Let's do a panel discussion. And I thought, oh, I want to get in on that. And so I wrote Dr. Sunderman privately and said, would you like to pitch a panel together where I'll be the patient voice? And then I shared my story with her. She responded within about 7 minutes and said, yes, I'd love to. Let's do it. And then the rest is history. And then they brought Dr. Janelle Gordon in, also a board certified ACLM doctor, to join us since our topics were similar. And we just had a blast collaborating, the four of us. And the panel was entitled, Is a Plant-Based Diet the Answer to Our Healthcare Crisis? And we believe, yes, it's one of them. I mean, certainly it's a multifactorial discussion, but that was the thrust of our discussion. And then, you know, the second part of your question in terms of what happened after that talk, yes, all four of us had individuals come up to us. From my perspective, I actually had a few survivors, and one of the sponsoring CEOs approached me, and, you know, a couple of survivors and then individuals that would say, my mother, my grandmother had breast cancer or passed away of breast cancer, and kudos to you. And, you know, they showed great empathy and interest in the topic and how we can heal ourselves through plants. So it was life-affirming, really, and validating.
It really is. So we're both members of the Women's Health Member Interest Group for the American College of Lifestyle Medicine, and I've gotten a little more involved as a secretary this year. And so that means that I get a little bit more insight as to what the subcommittees are doing. And one of the things that I feel like I've been called to do in terms of supporting the members of the Women's Health Group is to encourage them to get on platforms, just like you did, Kelly. Oh, you receive all this training, all this knowledge, and then you just kind of wonder, like, how do I share it outside of the clinic, I guess, as physicians or clinicians or dietitians? Like, how do you share the message? And one of the things that I often encourage people to do is go on podcasts, go on other people's shows, do like you just did, you know, pitch yourself to a summit in order to share this information, because many of the women that attended, and I should say it was men and women that attended the summit, but there were over 1,000 people who attended. And for some of them, it might have been the first time they heard about the power of nutrition using food as medicine, and probably even the first time they heard about lifestyle medicine. So mm-hmm. I just really commend you for doing this, for sharing your story. And here you are on my podcast today as a result of that.
You know, there are no accidents. So thank you. Yes, the fact that there was that intersection. And I agree with you. You know, we gather this knowledge, and it almost seems that it's a moral imperative to share it. And I felt that way as well. And also feel that, you know, it's incumbent upon me to use my experience to help others. That's part of my healing as well. And so, and I've always loved public speaking, I don't like to be on camera or any of that per se, but more so from the standpoint of, I love positively influencing others. And so that's what I think this has enabled me to do in some small way. And, you know, and also further my healing. So it's been a win-win.
Yeah. Absolutely. So I'd love for you to take us back to that moment when you received your breast cancer diagnosis. What were your initial thoughts and emotions? I mean, probably all over the place. I don't know how I would receive such a diagnosis. And how did they shape your journey from that point forward?
Sure. So interesting how that all started, in that I myself felt a lump, and it wasn't through monthly self-exams. I know we're all supposed to do that. I have a little placard in my bathroom from the breast center showing you how to do it. And we know what we're supposed to do, but I didn't do that. I had rolled over in bed and was adjusting my top or something, and and felt a lump the size of a grape. Now, it was in an area where, and my heart just sank. I kind of instantly knew this is not good. And I was going through a particularly stressful time at that juncture where I was about 6 months into a new job for a publicly traded company. A lot of stress, a lot of late days, nights. And actually, now that I think about it, I was kind of losing weight without trying, and I just attributed it to my lifestyle. And so at that time, I had actually been getting mammograms since I was 35. So even below the age they're recommended, because in that same area, I had a cyst that was suspicious. And so I was already on that cycle of I'd started with a diagnostic mammogram and ultrasound. It was all fine. So at the time when I felt it at age 44, I just figured maybe it's that cyst that's kind of inflamed or something. I didn't know any better. So I didn't dilly-dally. I did get in to my physician and she, rushed me through the system to get a stat mammogram and ultrasound. And I think intuitively knew that it was not going to be good news. And you talk about signs. I had a little prayer book in my purse that I hadn't looked at it in years, but I remember kind of thumbing through it in the waiting room that day. And I thought, let's just turn over to a random page. And the first little prayer that comes up is prayer for the sick, then prayer for the dying. Let's do best out of three here. Hope for another one. And the last prayer was the serenity prayer. Grant me the serenity to accept the things I cannot change, the courage to change the things I can, and the wisdom to know the difference. And I don't think that was an accident that I fell upon that page in that moment in that waiting room. Because what then happened was I proceeded with the mammogram. And then the next step, within minutes was to go into the ultrasound. And the tech, you know how it is with techs. I mean, they don't give you anything. You try to squeeze some information out of them. They're just tight-lipped. But she said to me, she says, just stay here for a moment. I'll be right back. And she came back and said, you have cancer. And it was as surreal and, as dramatic, if you will, as it is in the movies, right? And I think my first emotion to your question was disbelief, fear, really disbelief, shock. I mean, there is no history of cancer in my family. And, but actually, from a genetics hereditary standpoint, that only accounts for about 5 to 10% of breast cancer. So it's not as large of a percentage or driver as I think people think it is, genetics that is, and the hereditary factors. So, and then the first thing out of my mouth to the tech, and then some tears ensued, of course, was, I can't predecease my parents. I can't put them through that. And so for, I think, a split second, I thought maybe I don't even tell them because I'm an only child and I just didn't want to put them through that. So a lot going on in that moment. And this was an afternoon, April, was right at the end of March. And my formal diagnosis was on April 1st, but it was not an April Fool's joke, unfortunately. And so I went home, collected my thoughts and emotions. And then it's typical of me. I'm a big reader and I went to the local independent bookstore and thought, I got to get a book on this and figure this out. And I didn't want to go into Google land and playing Dr. Google and that whole scene. And so there weren't many books there. So I picked up this one, wasn't too fond of the title, but it was really perfect for me in that they were vignettes of well-known women who had battled breast cancer and they shared their story. Very well done. I really appreciated that book.
Can you read the title of it for listeners that might not?
Yes, yeah. Beat Breast Cancer Like a Boss.
That would have drawn me too. I'm going to beat it like a boss,
right.
Of course.
You know it. And so the first vignette or narrative that I landed on was that of Sheryl Crow, the musician. And she was actually the same age as me upon diagnosis. And one quote that stood out was one she shared from her radiologist, where she said, the radiologist said to her at the time of her diagnosis, don't miss out on the cancer lesson. I can't tell you what it is. It's different for everyone, but don't miss out on it. And mind you, this is the night of my breast cancer diagnosis that I'm reading this. And I marked it and highlighted it. And I was intrigued by it, And so So I really kind of went into this. I thought, there's something here. There's something I'm going to learn from this. And so as a lifelong learner, someone with a growth mindset, it intrigued me. And I thought, I'm going to go into this with an inquisitive mind and an open heart. And so I believe that also helped shape how I would then approach my course of action.
If I were diagnosed with something like that, I initially would go through that tremendous fear.
Yes.
Probably denial. But definitely fear. And then, but shifting your perspective to that of being, like you said, inquisitive, mm-hmm. has that level of empowerment too. Well, let me help to understand how breast cancer develops. What are those risk factors?
Right.
Rather than just being at the mercy of a diagnosis. I say at the mercy, but, you know, just feeling like there's nothing that you can do.
You know it, right? Maya. I think that's well said in that. I think the other piece of it, and believe me, this ebbed and flowed. I mean, I can remember the next day where I was, you know, in a real pity party. And so there were a myriad of emotions that ensued in those next 6 months, let's say. But you're right. I think there's a moment where you have to snap out of it and say, you know what, look, I, particularly with no hereditary component in my case, I had to also look at my lifestyle and say, look, I contributed to where I'm at today by some measure. This wasn't just the luck of the draw. I mean, yes, in some cases, perhaps is, because you do hear of individuals who are extremely healthy that still get breast cancer, die from breast cancer. So I don't want to diminish that. But at the same time, I thought, wait a minute, if I contributed to some degree, whether it's through lack of sleep or prioritizing exercise, you know, exercising haphazardly, or eating the standard American diet, though I would argue a healthier version of it, certainly too much sugar, a ton of coffee. I was fueling up on 8 cups of coffee a day, and that's raising cortisol levels, which is harmful for breast cancer. And so, you know, I contributed to where I am at, but then the inverse side of that is that I can also contribute to my healing. And so there, you know, you'd have these moments of that empowerment, which I think really got me through.
Absolutely. Mm-hmm. You said that you started doing your mammograms, having mammograms in your 30s. I think you said at the age of 35.
Yes.
And I remember I myself had very fibrocystic breasts from drinking coffee, I was told.
Yes, that's right.
Right. So for me, it became a habit of checking my breasts. But early on, I probably would have been maybe in my mid-20s. Late 30s.
Oh, okay.
I mean, late 20s, I'm sorry, wherein I started having a mammogram. And I, you know, I did have a scary moment during the pandemic where I also had a cyst, had to have it biopsied. And as I'm sitting there, Kelly, I'm realizing this is what women go through. This is it. This is how it all begins, in the sense, not cancer itself, right, but this is what we go through when we're feeling alone. Of course, during the pandemic, you couldn't really have company with you.
No, I didn't have anyone accompany me during this whole thing. And so that was tough too.
You went through this. Mm-hmm. Tell us how you decided on that initial plan, and what sort of team did you have to support you through your treatments?
Sure. So in terms of the care team, you know, some people approach it whereby I'm going to stay with one center. And so your initial doctor is typically a surgeon. And so I went with, I wanted to go to an academic center. Yeah, I live in the Los Angeles area, Southern California. So I'm very fortunate in that we have world-class cancer centers within 45 minutes of where I live. I have multiple centers. And so so the first thing was I actually went to the surgeon recommended by my primary care physician and met with her. And I'm sure she would have been terrific. But I then decided, you know what, I need a second opinion. And so I did get a second opinion. And her personality just aligned with how I approach things. She reminded me of a doctor version of me in business. And she was kind of like, I got this, you know, just, I appreciate all your questions. I know you're a biotech executive, or I was at the time. And she said, but let me get my spiel out and then we can address it. I thought, oh, I like her. And so she had kind of a take charge way about her, but a lot of empathy too, and a soft side. So we got along great. And so I went with her. I started with her. I didn't want to look too far ahead of myself. And because the other thing is, until the surgeon really gets in there, they don't know the full extent of what you're dealing with. They can't even really stage it until the pathology and all of that comes back. So I proceeded in May that year of 2021 with the a lumpectomy. She removed 6 sentinel lymph nodes. And for listeners and those viewing, the lymph nodes, if the lymph nodes are positive with cancer, that's what carries it throughout your system. So you never want a node positive diagnosis. Thankfully, my nodes were negative, but my tumor was sizable. It was right on the border of stage 1 and 2. So my tumor was 1.9 centimeters. If it were 2 centimeters, that would have pushed it over to stage 2 for node negative cancer. And so I was fortunate there. She got all the cancer, good margins. But then they send it out. Now, the unfortunate part, though, is it was a grade 3. And so I won't go through all the numbers, but basically an aggressive pathology, aggressive tumor type. And so that didn't bode well for me. And so that meant, okay, next step is going to be seeing an oncologist. That was the tricky part in assembling the team, really, because an oncologist will stay with you through potentially through the span of their, you know, as long as they're practicing, if you decide to stay with them. And so they're kind of your long-term partner. And so I just wanted to see someone immediately to know, okay, what are we dealing with here? What's the next step? So I did, from another separate institution. And I'm telling you, she was calling in chemo drugs for me before we were even off the Zoom call, which was a little disturbing. And I hadn't fully made my decision. And so I thought, no, I'm going to speak to someone else. And went to another oncologist deemed the guru at that particular institution. And she wasn't for me either. Saw a third one, no go. It wasn't until I landed on the fourth that I thought, okay, I found my person. And the reason I chose her, she happens to be a very highly regarded, you know, particularly in celebrity circles, oncologist. But that aside, that really didn't have anything to do with my decision. She was the only one that was fairly open-minded to my approach, which was against her advice. But she agreed to monitor me, and not all oncologists will. Because essentially they're just ordering labs, they're ordering imaging, they're addressing your concerns, hitting me up with some science when, you know, I want some evidence-based recommendations. And so not all of them will monitor you. So you've got to find someone that is really a good fit in that regard. I had to go to radiation, or I did opt to go to radiation, and that was at yet another institution. I had, my care team was comprised of clinicians from UCLA, City of Hope, and Cedars-Sinai. That's where my current oncologist is. Wow. So not common, kind of fragmented. I didn't have a quarterback on this whole thing. It was not easy, I won't lie. So,
did you introduce them to each other at any point?
We haven't had a little get together, a soiree just yet. But no, I mean, they communicate through portals and faxing and you know, as typical with physicians. But no, I can't say there's really been any kind of collegial discussion, or it's more in the hands that I think the surgeon kind of passes off to the oncologist. And so the oncologist is really more so the quarterback at this point. So she really drives all of my care right now.
I like how you put that. Yeah. This is very informative. Thank you. Almost like the quarterback. This is, you know, what you're discussing in terms of how you pretty much made a choice to become informed. You started with one book,
Beat Cancer Like a Boss. No, Beat Breast Cancer Like a Boss by Allie Rogan. I hope I'm pronouncing that correctly.
Yeah. So you started with the book, and then you sort of interviewed these specialists to see which would support, you know, the treatment plan that in a sense you wanted to choose for yourself, while you're still also taking their recommendations, listening, but you found someone that would really want to work with you. And I think that's part of what I like, Kelly, is bringing people like yourselves on the pod, like yourself on the podcast, who can educate all of us on how we can advocate for ourselves.
Excellent.
Because many times we give the power and the authority to the specialist, to the physician, to the surgeon, and then go and make decisions based on what they think is best for us. But intuitively, I guess some of us kind of do have a better feeling of what we should do to take care of our health. And so I appreciate you saying that. So what happened after that? And during this time when you were working with the oncologist, were you already aware of nutrition, or at what point did that come into the picture?
Yeah, thank you. So actually when I met it, so it didn't really come into the picture with my current oncologist. I was well on my way on my path when I found her. So when I met with the second oncologist, the so-called guru, the woman who had been deemed the guru at a local institution, I had to wait a month to see her. And so when I met with her, a very interesting story. It's really how it's the crux. It's the juxtaposition of how I even approach or how I even turn to plants for healing and a whole food plant-based diet. That and finding a book. That's really the crux of the story. Mm-hmm. So when I walked up to that building to meet with her that day, for my first appointment, the second oncologist I was interviewing, there was a little blue truck parked outside of the building, and call it a little ice cream truck. I mean, that's what it looked like. That's my recollection. I actually snapped a photo of it. It was, you know, royal blue, Dodger blue here in LA. But it was emblazoned with the word poison prominently featured and a skull and crossbones. So, wow, great introduction to my cancer treatment. And so I was a little bit unnerved by seeing that. I mean, to the extent I took a photo and sent it to a friend. And so I don't believe that was an accident, seeing that truck. And so I proceeded with the appointment. She recommended the same thing that the first oncologist did, a lengthy dose of what's known as the red devil, very toxic form of chemotherapy. It's bright red in color. They've got to wear a hazmat suit to pump this into you. And there can be debilitating cardiac impacts long-term from this therapeutic. You know, I went through the appointment just listening, taking a lot of notes. I came with all my studies, and I mean, she saw me coming. And so doctors must love me. And so at the end of the appointment, I've got my mom on speakerphone. She's silent. And at the end of the appointment, I said, okay, doc, I got it. So, but what about the power of nutrition to combat my cancer? And I don't recall necessarily suggesting I would, it was an either or question. Not that I'd negate all of what she was recommending. Which didn't just include chemo. It included forced menopause. So ovary suppression through either injections or removing my ovaries, which, you know, of course, produce estrogen in our bodies, but it's not the only way estrogen's produced. And then a 10-year course of an aromatase inhibitor, an AI, which dampens aromatase, which makes estrogen in our body. And so 10 years of that, which also I had read could be a very debilitating medication and joint pain. I mean, a whole host of issues. And so I thought, I'm 44 years old. And, you know, I just listened. And at the end of that discussion, I said, okay, wait, what about the power of nutrition, doc, to combat my cancer? And she said, oh, no. You know how many blueberries you would have to eat? They've done those studies. It would be impossible.
So disappointing.
Very disappointing, because we already know, as the panel of physicians at the Vegan Women's Summit that I shared the stage with, as they relayed, doctors don't, as a rule, know about nutrition. They get 0 to 8 hours of training in, you know, across their in medical school, their fellowship, residency. So, you know, I left there a bit defeated that day. But that weekend, yet again, I went back to a different bookstore. And what did I discover? This book here, Chris Beat Cancer. Now, you probably can't tell, those of you who are our viewers, but what is the logo behind his title here on the book? It's a skull and crossbones, but this one is comprised of a green apple and 2 carrot sticks. So I took that as my divine sign that, okay, wait a minute. I've got to, that was a nice juxtaposition with the little blue ice cream truck with the poison symbol at the cancer center. I thought, I think I've got my sign. And so I delved deeply into Chris Wark's protocol, and he was a colon cancer survivor about 20 years out, and it made all the sense in the world to me. And so I adopted this path within a week. I mean, I'm talking cleared the cupboards out. I think I might have had one piece of pizza in between that little period of time with some house-made chicken sausage. Okay, what doesn't matter. But the point is, I just went all in. I thought, I am going to overdose on nutrition. I am not looking back on this. My life depends on it, is how I approached it and still do to this day. So that was probably a longer version or a longer answer than what you expected, Maya, but I just wanted to kind of set the stage there for you and your viewers and listeners.
Well, I love the book. I love that it's also blue.
Yes.
Very similar to the truck that you saw with the skull and bones. And
I didn't even catch that until you just said that. I just was so focused on the symbol. You're right. It was blue.
Oh my goodness.
Love
it. I just have chills. Yeah, it's just amazing how information comes to us this way, how just life just supports you along the way, even through these tremendous times that you have with the, you know, the diagnosis. So Chris Carr was someone who I learned about years ago before I went plant-based, which has only been 7 years, but I saw a documentary. I don't know if you know her story. Have you seen
Yes, that? I have a book of hers. A friend had sent it to me.
Yeah, she did a documentary many years ago and hired a filmmaker, and they ended up getting married. And the documentary is a little bit harder to find nowadays. I don't know why, but it's her trying various types of therapies because I think she has stage 4 cancer,
right?
But I can't remember what it was. You know, that book came to me and started opening my eyes to the possibility of alternative therapies. And so I never want to discourage people from making a choice that they feel is right for them. I myself try to do more of the holistic approach, whatever I can do to avoid surgeries and having to take medication. So that's really interesting. So this book did a lot for you in terms of introducing you to the power of nutrition and really lifestyle also, right?
Lifestyle, yes. And so Chris Work, what I love about him is that he cites all of the references, you know, that he shares. They're evidence-based. He has a podcast that I highly recommend. Whenever I'm juicing, I listen to it. And he interviews cancer survivors, long-term cancer survivors. He interviews clinicians and really just arms you with a lot of data and a lot of sensible strategies you can use. So yeah, certainly nutrition, plant-based nutrition is the crux of what he suggests when you're going through active cancer. But there, you know, movement, exercise, but he also shares other intangible suggestions. So your spirituality, getting in touch with that, forgiveness, emotional release, any kind of old emotional baggage, dealing with that. And, you know, you can, sometimes there's talk on some of his blog posts or within the interviews about there are certain centers, whether it's the Gerson Therapy or Oasis of Hope down in Tijuana, different centers you can go to when you're really in the throes of cancer. But I remember something he said, you know, that's all great if you want to go do any of that. But at the same time, you're still coming back to the same environment. And so you have to look at the environment in which cancer grew, your emotional environment, your home life, whatever it may be, your work life. And so he takes a very holistic, comprehensive approach to what got us here. You know, what are some of those emotions and the conditions that also got us here?
I recently had a conversation with another breast cancer survivor that actually has the gene that puts her at risk for other cancers, including thyroid cancer, you name it. But one of the things that she told me, Kelly, and I'd love to hear this perspective from you, is that when we have conversations about reducing our risk for developing any type of cancer, that the goal is how we say it, in reducing our risk, because we can never say that we can completely 100% guarantee that we will prevent, for example, breast cancer through these changes. So she said it just by rephrasing that, by saying that we're just, you know, we're reducing our risk by making these lifestyle changes rather than preventing cancer. It makes the cancer, the individual who has, the survivor who has gone through this, feels less guilty about possible things that they may have done in the past, because you never stop trying to figure out what could have contributed to cancer growth, for example. What do you think about that?
That's an interesting perspective, and one I hadn't really given much thought to until you just shared it. So thank you for that. And so if I understand your point or her point, rather than talking about preventing it, so we don't kind of heap more guilt and negative emotions on ourselves because we're knowing that perhaps we've made choices that contributed, rather just focus on reducing risk. Is that the crux of the point?
Yes.
Okay. To kind of dampen the, or soften the edges around the negative emotions. You know, that's a great point. I think in the earlier days of my diagnosis, in that first year, 2021, and maybe even parts of 2022, I did kind of obsess about what caused this. And even now, if I skip a day of juicing or exercise, oh my goodness, and I'm getting too stressed, my heart's beating fast at night because I have anxiety about whatever's going on in the day. Is cancer going to return? There is an element of that that still even lingers with me. But, you know, where I take comfort is it's progress, not perfection. Am I perfect at the whole regimen and protocol that I'm engaged in right now for my, I'll start saying not prevention, but risk reduction? No. Do I put on a little bit of weight here and there more so than the new me weight and the new ideal? Sure. If I'm eating out with friends and all vegan, of course, but you know, we can't control or we don't necessarily know that if they're putting salt in certain things and that sweet green salad dressing or whatever it is. And so we can't control all those factors. And so, but we also can't obsess about them. And so I like that approach. I agree with your guest that I think, you know, we certainly have to live our life and we can't obsess over certain things that may not be within our control or past mistakes and missteps. And do I have regrets in life? Sure. But I choose to just kind of not really look in the rearview mirror too much and just look forward, because that's all we have is today. Yeah. It's all we're guaranteed,
yes.
Right?
Absolutely. My life coach, who has some NLP training and other things like that, we do a lot of body work. But when I go in circles about my past, she always guides me to say, that was then, and yes, this is now.
Yes.
And it's not to say that sharing your story is not important. It's more like stop blaming yourself, because that's a lot of what we do.
Yes.
Now, I get what you're saying, because when I started to learn, I haven't had tremendous health problems, but I did have hypothyroidism, mm-hmm, and other issues like the adrenal gland issues and extreme fatigue. And I had the whole mercury poisoning from eating too much fish and all of that. So, I mean, I did have things happen to me as well. When I was dealing with especially extreme fatigue, somewhere along the line, I discovered or started reading Louise L. Hay, You Can Heal Your Life.
Yes.
And then that I became aware, this is before lifestyle medicine and all of that, but I became aware of how angry I was, how stressed out I was, the trauma that I underwent, you know, experienced as a child, and how all of that could be affecting my health. And these are things that are not necessarily mentioned in medicine. And even I think lifestyle medicine is starting to address that when you talk about having healthy relationships and managing your stress, getting that exercise. But a lot of times it just really sticks with us, whatever it is that we went through. And then there's that self-talk, that negative talk that we tend to have that could potentially contribute to disease as well.
Yes, totally agree with that. And that is something that Chris's work talks about, is forgiveness. And so it's, what is that quote about, you know, holding on to anger is like swallowing the poison and expecting the other person to die. I mean, it's that sort
That's
of
right.
concept. And yes. And so I agree with your life coach, and I'm happy to hear that it sounds like that work has been beneficial to you and that mindset.
Absolutely.
It's wonderful, man.
Well, it's everything. It's a combination, right? Like when you were sharing that, Chris said, so, you know, what's the point? And not necessarily what's the point, but you're working on the nutrition aspect. But what about your environment, your immediate environment, and how toxic is that in terms of like who you're surrounding yourself by and the things? There's so much to cover, in general, there are so many things to consider along the way. And that's why we're having these conversations. We're just exploring possibilities of, you know, how we can be impacted.
Indeed.
I wanted to go back to your story, mm-hmm, and I wanted to know what happened next. Like after you finally worked with the fourth oncologist that you decided to work with. So you didn't do the red pill or the red devil.
No red devil.
You call it.
No chemo. And and so instead, I overdosed on nutrition. I bought a juicer. I think I was using my Vitamix until the juicer arrived a week later. And I juiced, and I was following Chris's recipe, you know, carrots, a green apple, it's lower on the glycemic index, half a beet, turmeric, ginger root, celery. I mean, I was juicing all of this, all before work. I mean, you got to figure this is during the pandemic, so you got to be on Zoom for your meetings at 8 a.m. And I'm getting up early. I'm making three juices for myself, and I'm drinking these mixtures. This talk about the red devil. I'm drinking this red beet juice, And my colleagues said, "Oh, Kelly's drinking her Bloody Marys." You know, that's what this one colleague would joke. And so I'm drinking this stuff all throughout the day on these Zoom meetings. I think there was a part of me that was good for me to be still working as hard as I was during that period, because I think there was an element where I wanted to show my colleagues, I'm okay. I'm fine. I'm okay. I'm doing this. And so that was also positive for me to keep my mind off it. And so, yes, I was juicing about, I would make about 48 ounces of vegetable fruit juice, namely vegetables, carrot, and, you know, carrots, leafy greens, all of that. And I could tell a difference. I mean, I did a before and after picture of myself, about 2019 and then 2022 after this whole regimen. It's like night and day. Not in terms of weight. I never was heavy. I mean, I lost about 10 pounds, but just the overall health. Even now, my hair is so thick and unruly, I can't even manage it because all of this nutrition, my nails grow so fast, all of it. And so I went raw, primarily raw vegan, with a whole food plant-based diet. I want to make that distinction when I say vegan. For me, it's always going to be whole food plant-based. Probably the first 6 months was primarily raw. And when I say raw, you know, that was the juicing, large salads at night for dinner, and then maybe a few cooked vegetables like the mushrooms, the broccoli, the stuff that's really supportive to combat cancer. And then I started inserting some regular exercise in there. You can see my bike in the background. I think I had a trampoline in the background. So at one point as well, a rebounder. And so started that up religiously. I got into a support group. So, you know, there's the cancer support community throughout Southern California, but it's nationwide, as I've since learned. And that's a free resource available to anyone going through active cancer and then up to 2 years after they finish treatment. So, you know, they, for instance, give you 8 free counseling sessions, one-on-one counseling sessions, support groups, classes on nutrition, and also just positive things to keep your mind off what you're going through, you know, Reiki, watercolor painting, cooking, whatever interests you, photography. I mean, they have a whole host of classes. So I think it's important to get plugged into a community as well like that, or it was for me. And lymphatic massage, high dose vitamin C. I started working with a naturopath, mistletoe injections, which is one of the most popular cancer therapies in Europe, particularly Germany. Activate your immune system. And, and so I started on things like that. Fasting was another one. And all of this, by the way, these are things, perhaps except the vitamin C and the high dose vitamin C infusions and, the mistletoe, all things I still do today. So fasting, I try to do a 12-12 schedule where I stop eating at 7, don't eat until 7 the next morning. And then I do a course of Prolon, the fasting mimicking diet, every 3 to 4 months. I just completed a cycle on Saturday. And so, you know, there's some great data behind that Prolon protocol, Dr. Mm-hmm. Walter Longo out of USC, whereby it helps initiate apoptosis and autophagy, just fancy words for cell death. And so, you know, because the danger, why we hear about recurrence, you know, I've certainly known many, well, maybe not many, but numerous, multiple cancer survivors who are surprised when they encounter a reoccurrence after they've just gone through all the traditional treatment. It could be 10 years later, it could be 15 years later. And the reason is some of these cells escaped, even if you didn't have positive nodes, you know, these cells can lodge in your bones, liver, lung, brain, in the case of breast cancer. And so we've got to stay vigilant in ensuring we don't foster an environment for that to take off. And so these are just some of the modalities that I began. And I started working with a nutritionist at Dr. Walter Longo's clinic, the Cancer Cures Foundation in Santa Monica. So
awesome. Yeah. I'm going to have to add these links.
I'd be happy to share that with you. I have a little list. I've actually compiled a resource list that I share with other survivors when people ask, because I get the question so often. I thought I got to just make a little guide. So yeah. I did that.
Yeah. I was wondering if you can cover two therapies that you, I call them therapies, but two approaches that you took, the juicing and the fasting, and why that was. Now, I am familiar with the Gerson therapy. Mm-hmm. I actually saw documentaries on Gerson and the work that he was doing in terms of helping cancer patients. And that sort of had to be moved into Northern Mexico, I believe, because you couldn't really practice that in the States at one point, or probably still in saying that juicing can actually help cancer patients. So if you can talk about what Chris says about that, why juicing works and fasting as well, because my husband's deep into the whole fasting and longevity.
Sure.
And what do we know about fasting? How can that support the body? And just to be clear, if you can clarify it again, you already had done the procedure. So you had the tumor removed.
Yes.
So it didn't spread to the limbs. So it's not like you were doing either of these to get rid of anything else. It's more, like you said, to reduce your risk of recurrence.
That's an important distinction, exactly. I think, Maya, because, you know, before I got cancer, I didn't really understand. I mean, you see this popularized in movies and the media of people getting chemo and whatnot, but I didn't really understand, you know, how that worked or, you know, at what point in their treatment that was being implemented. And in my case, and it's different depending on your stage and all the type of cancer you have. So I don't want to speak, you know, broadly here, but in my case, first of all, just to clarify, I have the most common type of breast cancer. So invasive ductal carcinoma, and it's ERPR positive, HER2 negative, so hormone driven. And this type of cancer, the invasive ductal carcinoma, accounts for about 75 to 80% of cases. So that's the good news, because it's more prevalent, and therefore there's more treatment, more is known about it. And so there's more treatment available. And so that being said, though, in my case, so stage one, in the staging, though, it came back where I had a high oncotype. And I won't go into all the nuances of that. But that was a molecular test that was done where it took a piece of my tumor and dissected it and found and then compared it. There's a company that does this oncotype test to see against other samples and women to look at if I'd benefit from chemotherapy. And so I had a high oncotype score, unfortunately. That was really the bad news of this. And so I'm at high risk for reoccurrence. My oncologist says, you know, we can't even estimate what you're at because no one's doing studies on the path you're following, really large scale studies. But she said, I would say it's well over 40% based off your oncotype and for reoccurrence. But the good news is that means there's a 60% chance of it not coming back, right? So talk about the neuro-linguistic programming and positive thinking, right? But the point is, so chemo, in my case, would have been what I would term a prophylactic. It would have been, I would have done that to prevent cancer from taking off elsewhere in my body if a cell escaped from during the point of surgery, let's say. So you see my point that I would carpet bomb my body with the red devil on the chance that perhaps some dangerous cells escaped. So I'm not a gambling woman, but I just thought, you know what? I think I'm going to take my chance on that and hedge my bet and overdose on nutrition. And so, you know, Chris, in his book, he recommends the raw juicing because that's a way, you know, the juice moves through your system very quickly. You get those nutrients. And I know what some docs will say, my nutritionist will say this too, that are concerned about you're losing out on the fiber, right? If you were to make a smoothie, for instance, instead, that would have the whole part of the apple, right? And the fiber in an apple and some of those fruits and vegetables. But juicing is a way to just really get a concentrated amount of nutrients because you could never eat that many vegetables. When I talk about juicing, I was juicing about 5 pounds of carrots a day. So that big bag you see in the supermarket, and all organic, of course, that you see in the supermarket, I was going through one of those a day. They thought I had a horse at home to feed or something when people would see me in the market.
Yeah. No, I get it because when I met my husband, I was living in San Diego. So the lifestyle there fostered my interest. Right. And I was very much into the Gerson therapy, even though, like I said, I didn't have a lot of things to... I wasn't dealing with a lot of health issues, but I was well known at my local grocery store, farmer's market kind of a place. I mean, I did my rounds all the time
right.
because I juiced a lot.
Wonderful.
I juiced a lot. And people, you know, sometimes believe that juicing is just for weight loss. So you remember the documentary Fat, Sick, and Nearly Right. Dead, you know, the Joe, idea yeah. of that. You know, yeah. And then that he didn't really sustain that lifestyle. But what you were doing is just supporting your cells.
Yes.
Reviving your cells, energizing them, just boosting the body so that it can be optimized and it could fight any potential reoccurrence that could happen, for example.
Correct. And also eliminating processed foods. Now, I'm not suggesting I eat a lot of processed food. I didn't. But at the same time, you know, I think I was shocked when I'd go through the grocery store, Trader Joe's and the different places we would shop to see the list of, you know, of ingredients and things that are seemingly healthy. And so I became very conscious of anything I put into my body, onto my body. And so that also entailed detoxifying my environment. I got rid of some nonstick pans and bought special cookware and only drink and eat on glass and nothing plastic at all in the house. And you know, if you even look at the Starbucks cups, you know, we're drinking hot liquid through that plastic and we don't know what's really happening there, that chemical reaction with the heat and all of it. So just, you know, I became very conscious of all of this. And so juicing just seemed, it just seemed to make sense to me to really get that much nutrition into my body because I could, again, I could never consume 5 pounds of carrots in a day. Whole. And so I think I just intuitively thought that made sense. And so that was one reason I chose that. And that's part of Chris's protocol. He said, do this for 90 days at least. And I did it for about 6 months. And now I was drinking about 48 ounces of juice at that time. Now I drink 16 ounces of juice, basically one little mason jar I make every day.
Yeah.
So that was number one.
Sweet.
Yeah. And then number two, you said the fasting, correct? That was the other.
Yeah.
The fasting, piece of it.
Yes.
Yeah. So the fasting, I chose that because I listened, actually it was Chris. He had interviewed Dr. Walter Longo on one of his podcasts, whom I'd never heard of. And, you know, Dr. Longo presented, as you know, he's the author of The Longevity Diet, and he presented evidence, peer-reviewed published evidence of how fasting, he wasn't suggesting it as a replacement for chemotherapy, but a complementary therapy that actually enhanced the potency of chemotherapy is my recollection of it. And so it wasn't, again, an either or, but a complementary therapy. He's a real doctor. And so I just thought, wow, there's some solid science behind this. And, you know, in mouse studies, his fasting mimicking diet is as effective as chemotherapy, which I found astounding. And,
wow.
So, you know, so the fasting mimicking diet, in this case, Prolon, it reduces excess fat. And so why is that important within, in the discussion of breast cancer, you know, maintaining an ideal weight? Well, even when we hit menopause, as you know, we're still producing estrogen. Because in the adiposity and the fat in our fat stores, it's converting aromatase into other hormones, and aromatase is converting other hormones into estrogen. And so estrogen fuels my cancer type. And so I always say that if I want to live a long, vibrant life, I can never be overweight or obese. So I've always got to watch that because of that estrogen component. And so the other piece is Prolon promotes stem cell-based rejuvenation. And the stem cells are what can cause the cancer to take off. If it's, you know, I've got something hiding out in my liver, for instance, or my bones. And then most importantly for me, I think what I kind of latched onto was the fasting. This doesn't just speak to Prolon, but just even the 12-12 or whatever schedule someone wants to initiate. Because some people go, you know, on one day, off one day on fasting. But it triggers apoptosis and autophagy, cell death. So the cell death. So that those ideas really appealed to me. And, you know, even now, God forbid, if I ever got a diagnosis of metastasis, a reoccurrence, I already know exactly what I would do. I wouldn't have the reaction of, darn, I missed out on that chemo. I really should have done it 10 years ago, 20 years ago when I had the opportunity. In fact, I wouldn't, that would not be my thought, at least now, you know, who knows? I can't speak to how I'll think years from now, but from what I know now, my thought would be, no, I already know where I'd go. I'd go right to True North Health up in Santa Rosa, California, and do a medically supervised water fast for as long as I could handle it. So yeah. That's what I'd do.
Absolutely. So now, where are you today with your health? How often do you have to sort of follow up with your doctors, and what have they said about where you are? Because clearly, you never had the chemotherapy. You look great.
Thank you.
You look vibrant. Thank you. I'm sure your energy levels are even higher.
They are.
As a result of that lifestyle change.
Yes. Yes, indeed. I've done tremendously well, knock on wood, and by God's grace, I'm very grateful. Now, how do we know? You know, we can look a certain way, we can feel good, but, you know, I might argue I felt okay back then when I was diagnosed too. So I think it's important to have some objective evidence here. And I'm fortunate in that my oncologist monitors me very closely. And so that entails seeing her we're now on a 4-month cycle. We went from 3 to 4 every 4 months, so 3 times a year. And also imaging. So I actually just had a breast MRI. I do mammograms. I do ultrasounds. It just depends on which modality, but anywhere from every 6 months to a year. And, you know, the kind of unfortunate part is anytime I have an ache or pain that might just be related to normal aging or injury, of course, the first thought is, oh gosh, it's migrated to the bones. I better get in there and contact Cedars. So she works with me on that and orders the appropriate studies. And, you know, I had some bilateral shoulder pain. It turned out not to be metastasis, thankfully, but just 2 slightly torn rotator cuffs. So went from playing tennis to now playing pickleball. So every ache and pain has been either benign or, you know, some other age-related change. So I've been really fortunate, but she humors me and orders all of this for me. And then, you know, I have labs before every appointment, a full blood panel, and all the cancer markers, and they're pristine. I mean, they were better than they were before the cancer. My cholesterol dropped 40 points. I'd always hovered in that 190 level, at that 190 level. I'm now at 150. And, you know, my LDL at one point got a little high. And at one point, a physician had suggested a statin, which I declined. And so no need for any of that anymore. I mean, it's all in check. And I also have a circulating tumor cell test, Natera, Signatera, I believe is the name of it, the company. And pretty fascinating test, one of those liquid biopsy type tests where they take a piece of my tumor that was frozen at the hospital where I had my surgery. And then they regularly, every quarter, every 6 months, just depending, they look at, is there any trace of that tumor of those cells of that protein from the original tumor in my bloodstream, in my blood sample? And so that can be an early warning light for, wait a minute, we might have a problem. And so I have that every quarter, that test. And so that's about all we can do, you know, at this juncture. I mean, that's really it, but it's all come back clear. So I'm really fortunate.
That's wonderful. Yes. I'm so happy for you. I'm so glad that you're able to share your story with us.
Thank you for having me.
And so, you know, as you know, this month for Breast Cancer Month, it's a vital reminder for women to prioritize their health. And I feel like we can't tell women enough, you know, and I'm including myself. We can't encourage ourselves enough to take care of ourselves because we prioritize everyone else. But what advice would you give us women about the importance of regular screenings and early detection?
Sure. First off, just don't put it off. Don't make any excuse about, you know, why you can't have your mammogram or any type of medical appointment. Like you said, you know, we often put others first. So schedule it around your birth date or whatever date you can, you know, just remember like clockwork. For me, I always schedule my imaging, my annual mammogram and ultrasound in my case around the day of my diagnosis, April 1st. And so that's my mark. And so that would be number one. Number two, if God forbid a woman receives a diagnosis, try to guard against making a fear-based decision and just following what the first doctor you meet with recommends. The reality is, and I say all of this with the caveat is, of course, it depends on what stage you're at and, you know, your particular situation. I'm not a physician, but at the same time, you know, cancer didn't form overnight, right? By some estimates, we'll never know it precisely, but some estimates say, you know, by the time a tumor is detected, it's been there at least 5 years. So my cancer likely took anywhere from 2 to 10 years to form. And so if I want to take another 2 weeks, 3 weeks to make my decision on my course of treatment, take it, do the research, talk to other clinicians, get second opinions, third opinions, however many opinions you need to feel okay. And the other thing I would say is trust your intuition, follow that inner wisdom, as I did with, you know, when I looked for the signs and did my research. There's a great book, another book I have here, which I'll point out. She has a few. Kelly A. Turner, PhD, Radical Remission and Radical Hope. Those are two books of hers that I have. And what she's done is she has looked at the traits, the factors that have contributed to the survival of long-term cancer survivors. What traits do they have in common? Not character traits, but strategies, what they've done, what they subscribe to. And out of those 10, believe it or not, only 3 are tangible, the ones we'd expect: exercise or movement, herbs and supplementation, and nutrition. The other 7, one of them is follow your intuition, you know, and then social support and some of the other pillars, much like the ACLM recommends, lifestyle medicine recommends. And so I can't stress enough how important it is to follow what's right for you, what your belief is, and then get plugged into a community, you know, of other survivors, whether it's the cancer support community that I mentioned earlier, and talk to other people, get other inputs. And then I think you can make a well-informed decision. Oh, one more thing, Maya, I don't want to forget, super passionate about this. If you're told you have dense breasts, insist on an ultrasound. 10 to 15% of cancers are not detected on mammograms. And I was one of those cases. Now, I am not blaming anyone for this. I'm not blaming the imaging center. The reality is, while I was getting mammograms from 35 on, sure, I'd get a letter in the mail, you're fine, come back in a year. And I know there was some little one-liner or footnote in there to say, you have dense breasts, you know, cancer may not be detected, et cetera. Now, shame on me for not taking that further, pushing the envelope there and questioning my primary care doctor or GYN about, wait a minute, what should we be worried about this? Should we be doing anything about it? Or insisting on an ultrasound myself, because my hunch is that the ultrasound would have picked it up. Because when I've looked at my images, my mammogram images, it is a white snowstorm. You can't see anything. And so again, the only thing that detected it, recall the tech came in and told me I had cancer right there on the spot after the ultrasound, was the ultrasound. And so it should be covered. If it isn't, pay for it out of pocket if you can. Find a way to a resource, because we have to be our own advocate in that regard.
I enjoy what you say about making an informed decision, being educated in this area. We've provided a lot of resources that I'll put in the show notes, okay, including Chris's book. Also, the other book that I like, that I, once I started learning about all of this and the risks that we have, especially as we age, yes, as women get older, our risks go increase. I also began to learn that drinking alcohol has been associated with various types of cancers.
Yes.
I couldn't believe that. I was like, how did I not know all this?
I know.
But I bought Dr. Christy Funk's book, Breast, the Owner's Manual, and I just went through it. And there's a lot of information about the various types of breasts,
yes,
and the density, just like you were talking about, and understanding what to look for, just overall breast health. And then myths. She does address certain myths about what can contribute to breast cancer, which I actually used to believe the underwire bras contributed.
Right.
I don't know. I still don't know. But I made a change many years ago, also moving away from deodorant, because I believe that that could also increase my risk for breast cancer. So she addresses all of these things. And then she goes into what we can do to reduce our risk, and then includes I want to say recipe. So that one was a great book. Is there anything else, Kelly, that you would like to say to my listeners?
Sure. Thank you, Maya. This has been a great pleasure to team up with you again and get a chance to learn from you, speak with you and visit, and also share my story with your audience. And, you know, I would just say that there are certain things, going back to, you know, the serenity prayer, which we began with here. There are things that we will not be able to change in our lives and in our health journey, but there are many that we can. And I think it's well within our control when we use the pillars of lifestyle medicine to enjoy a long and vibrant life. And I wish that for all of your listeners and you as well. And I'm wishing everybody well and grateful for my life and my journey and the opportunity to be here today with you. So thank you.
Yeah. Well, thank you. And actually, one last question.
Yes.
When it comes to sharing your story, is there anything else that's in the works for you?
Oh, yes. Thank you. Not at this very moment, though. You know, I am in between professional opportunities right now. I resigned from my job as a biotech executive a couple months ago, and I am looking at new opportunities and would love to do something in the field of food as medicine and nutrigenomics or precision nutrition. And it's still a very nascent early field, and so I haven't found the right fit there yet. But I am looking into those opportunities, and I may develop a course or write an ebook myself about some of these strategies that we've discussed today. And so, who knows? I think a book, a podcast, something. My second book could be in the works. That deals with my journey here. So I'm open to that, and certainly I'm always open to speaking in forums like this. So, but nothing is scheduled yet. Let's put it that way.
Yeah. Well, I can see that in you, though. All of it, everything you've listed, from a course, a book, a podcast. I think you will really create something that's very informational, educational for all of us, especially because you did try other modalities, because you went into the fasting and the juicing and all the, just other things that people still question.
Right.
But it seems like you are well-informed, very resourceful, and I'm going to continue to follow you and learn from you as well.
So very kind.
Thank you so much, Kelly.
Thank you, Maya.
Thank you for being with us.
My great pleasure.
Bye-bye.
Take care. Good to see you. Bye-bye.
You've been listening to the Healthy Lifestyle Solutions podcast with your host, Maya Acosta. If you've enjoyed this content, please share with one friend who can benefit. You can also leave us a 5-star review at ratethispodcast.com/HLS. This helps us to spread our message. As always, thank you for being a listener.